Welcome back to Coast AM. And Tobias Churton stays with us. I read with interest in your book, Tobias, about how a British Prime Minister at the time, Harold Wilson, this is around 1964, he saw the subversive potential of the Beatles, and he wanted to try and co-opt them, really, I guess, to his ideas, so that they could be sort of change agents for, I guess, the establishment's idea of progress. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yes, I mean... When Harold Wilson was asked about the Beatlemania, which I think for a lot of socialists in Britain was sort of, they were rather shocked by it in the political world, because this was something that seemed to be almost out of government control. And he said, well, at least the Beatles keep the kids off the streets. This was the big fear of those days, or what were called teddy boys, emerged in the 50s. Sort of street fighting, youth subculture. There were the mods and rockers was the famous thing. In the early 60s, in the summertime, the mods who listened to The Who and rode Lambretta motor scooters would go to the coastal resorts, and there'd be fights with the rockers who preferred motorcycles and that tend to have slightly longer greasy hair, whereas the mods were smart, and they'd sort of have fights and stuff like this. And the government was very concerned that youth was coming out of control. So Harold Wilson thought, well, we will try and co-opt the Beatles' goodwill and try and get them, as it were, to set good examples, you know, because they're clean hair and all this sort of thing. And, of course, then came the Rolling Stones, which sort of... Then you've got a kind of mods and rockers situation in the pop charts between the Stones, who are regarded as more rebellious and more out of control, and the Beatles, who were beginning to look smarter and more fashionable and more reasonable sounding and more sophisticated musically. So that was the government was very concerned that the youth was on the, you know, could tip the scales politically. And it's quite interesting nowadays where when the Tony Blair government came in, Blair made a huge effort to co-opt Oasis, the band, and to get the idea that it was hip to be socialist, it was hip to vote Labour. That was the, and you still get a lot of that today in the youth culture, is this energy of youth. Politicians see it and they want to manipulate it. They always get it wrong, of course, because the kind of people who make interesting changes in music are individualists generally, and while they may have political views, I can't think of many who want to thrust them on their following. It just shows that there is a perceived power in the music and in the youth, certainly in the 60s, and a lot of world leaders and the Pope were terrified, really. The youth was going to overthrow all of their sense of home, their sense of the familiar. And, of course, young people have always, I think, if you go back to the old Akkadian myths of ancient Babylonia, I remember the lovely story about the older gods decide to attack the young gods because they're making too much noise and disturbing the peace. That's an sort of eternal battle between the generations. They talked about a generation gap in the 60s. I think there's always going to be some sort of generation gap. But it did widen in the 60s. I think, for example, in the working classes in England, the idea that you followed your father down the pit, you know, dad worked in a mine, therefore the son works in a mine and his son's going to work in a mine, and we always work in mines, and you follow your father. I think that gulf starts to widen. Largely because the younger generation often had as much or more income than their parents had, and there were more opportunities, so there was more freedom to do what you wanted personally rather than conforming necessarily. But in the end, of course, everybody will conform to some degree or other, and that's certainly true in the 60s, and then you get a new, in the 70s, it'd be the conformist thing is to look like the 60s, you know. So every revolutionary movement ends up generating a new conformity. I mean, it's fascinating when, after the wall came down between the Soviet bloc and the Western world, that you had a nostalgia for Stalin suddenly emerges. The moment you've got democracy and in or some form of it in Moscow under Yeltsin and set up by Gorbachev, you immediately get the old Stalinists come out of the woodwork and say how great it was back in the 50s, you know.
Right.
I would never, I mean, when politicians mess with pop music, I would always say, get your alarm bells ringing.
Right. I'll call it the establishment, did they get behind the Beatles at a certain point? Because, you know, they were playing Hamburg and they were playing the Cavern Club every night, and then all of a sudden there was just like, they just took off. And I'm just wondering, is that the establishment deciding, okay, let's get behind these, let's put the machine behind these four lads, and then we can control them?
No, well, of course they didn't and couldn't, and that was the disconcerting thing. And I don't think governments are ever that smart to actually get I don't think anyone in government saw the nascent potential of the Beatles. I don't think hardly anyone saw it. The only person really who saw it, apart from the fans in the Cavern Club and the German existentialist students in Hamburg, was Brian Epstein. And Brian Epstein had to go against his family, i.e. the establishment, to put so much support behind the Beatles and to really suffer on their behalf, going down to London to get rejection slips from practically every record company he spoke to. And the Beatles' breakthrough was sheer luck, if you like, in the sense that that wasn't... Rejection was the much more likely prospect. And Decca Records, of course, famously turned them down. And Parlophone, which they eventually signed up with, was actually regarded as a novelty label that did comedy records, Peter Sellers records and things like that. So the Beatles actually come out under a novelty label, you know. So the government was never smart enough to get in with the Beatles. And anyway, the Beatles were very intelligent individuals, which was also a great shock to the media when they became so extraordinarily famous. They realized they weren't talking to a couple of working class, uneducated people from, the tenements, who could hardly say much more than yes, please, or whatever it was. They were dealing with actual art students. I mean, John Lennon had been at art college. He'd been at grammar school. Paul McCartney was studying to be a teacher. They were thoughtful and interesting and culturally aware young men. It was a great shock. And I think when they arrived in America, and you see those early interviews when they turn up in New York in the late winter of 1964, I think the Americans thought they were going to be easy pie. You know, the American journalists thought they're going to be easy to manipulate, but they were sort of taken aback by their spontaneity and originality, and in fact were charmed by them. So, no, the establishment only got worried when I think particularly, well, Harold Wilson was particularly worried when the drug thing emerged, and the press built all that up and amplified it, and then it became truly threatening because, of course, if you're into personal exploration of the mind, you are much less susceptible to government, any form of establishment control of the citadel of your thinking. And I think that then the Beatles start to seriously worry the authorities. No, the establishment wanted to identify themselves with the Beatles. This is what Harold Wilson was trying to do. He was trying to say, yeah, well, your Labour government is really like the Beatles. We're forward-looking. We care about young people. We're dynamic. We're hard-working. And there's a sort of rhythm. And he used, Harold Wilson used all sorts of phrases to suggest that, you know, industrial relations could be somehow hip. And he talked about the white heat of technological progress, things that I don't think the Beatles were remotely interested in. The Beatles were never interested in industrial relations or manufacturing or things like that. Their interests were artistic and I'd say they were artistic and cultural.
You were talking earlier about, you know, the mods and the rockers, and I want to talk about the freaks, because Frank Zappa, the Mothers of Invention, you write about him, and because you were talking also about the individualists and how a lot of counterculture, ultimately they become conformists, but not Frank Zappa and the freaks. Talk to me about the freaks. Who were they?
Well, freaks are self-proclaimed non-conformists who didn't want to be identified with a kind of newspaper man's idea of what a hippie was. So Frank Zappa is obviously the greatest example. I'd say Jimi Hendrix actually comes pretty well onto the freak flag, as he wrote in one of his songs, I think, If Six Was Nine, was it? He said, I'll keep my freak flag flying. The freak is usually an intelligent, sensitive being who rebels against the plasticity and inauthenticity of the establishment idea of life. I think this is one of the big themes of Frank Zappa, is he uses that word plastic. You're plastic this, you're plastic that, you're plastic doll, you're plastic, you know. The word plastic, which, of course, in the early 60s is a revolutionary a technological breakthrough, because there are so many products suddenly being made in plastic that used to be made in leather, wood, and so forth. So it's part of the new money coming in. Post-war industrial investment in plastics is huge, and then Frank Zappa saying, no, plastic represents something that's superficial, cheap, opaque, and it's not real. It's not real. Now, this, of course, is one of the great themes of the 60s counterculture, is authenticity. Be yourself. You've got to, you know, live from your soul. So the freak is somebody who says, you know, yeah, he grows his hair, but not to because he wants to be a Beatle. He grows his hair because he just fancies doing it, and because it's a statement of individuality. So, you know, Zappa had the Zapata moustache, and he very much cut his own figure. But to those who didn't understand the nuances, of course, he would have looked like another hippie. But if you listen to his music and his lyrics, they're much more challenging philosophically. And when I was growing up, the people who are into Zappa tended to be university undergraduates and graduates, and Zappa was more technically proficient on guitar and in composition than many of the mainstream pop performers, for sure. So that's your freak is your individualist, and very much critical of the kind of peace and love solution. The freak is not somebody who just mindlessly says, yeah, man, if we all kind of loved each other, the world would be a gorgeous place. He's going to be a bit more, he's more challenging than that, and probably a bit more political. You get a very strong sense of it from Zappa's album, We're Only in It for the Money, 1967, which is quite extraordinary reaction to hippiedom, actually. It's the first rock reaction to the hippies, long before the punks. And he really takes Haight Ashbury and San Francisco down. You know, his view of it is that this is just another form of inauthentic conformity. The kids are growing hair because they think they should. They're wearing flowers because that's what the other guy's doing. You know, that song of Scott McKenzie, if you go to San Francisco, wear flowers in your hair, created this flood of young people who thought there was a kind of Shangri-La on the West Coast. And then, of course, they arrive there and find they can't afford to live and end on the street and vulnerable to exploitation and so on. And that was another of the unfortunate side effects of the period, was the younger, you know, pre thoroughly educated children got a kind of harlequin idea, Pied Piper notion, that if they just followed the pipes, they'd all end up in paradise. And that brought a lot of negativity into the movement and discredited it. But it's interesting that people like Zappa and the Freaks were already looking at that aspect. I think Jimi Hendrix said, I don't care whether your hair is short or long. It's what you are inside that counts. And do you see, do you feel, are you aware? Those are the badges of the 60s aware person, is that you've got to be aware of things and be able to think for yourself and be an individual and care about others. So you get all of that aspect. So it's always a mistake to caricature aspects of the 60s, because there was a great deal of disagreement among themselves. I mean, how do you compare a band like The Doors, for example, with, Jefferson Airplane? I mean, they're so very different.
Right.
Philosophically, they're in a different space.
You mentioned Frank Zappa and how he used to refer to plastic a lot. And it's funny, I know you write about this in the book, but the other night, my wife and I were watching The Graduate on Amazon Prime. And there's, of course, that classic scene. Exactly. Go into plastics, because that was the future, right? One word, plastics. That's where the bread is.
Yeah,
but and it's much maligned, of course. But you actually are kind of you got kind of nostalgic for plastic, the plastic toys and things back then.
Yes. Yeah. You've raised an interesting point. I do go in the book into the quality of the toys of that period. There's a massive rise in quality in certain companies. In the United Kingdom, for example, there was a company called Britons who made soldiers and cowboys and Indians, and they also did a whole thing on the American Civil War with Union and Confederate troops. And they were all made of plastic, without which they probably wouldn't have been able to be made. But they also had metal components. They did knights from the 14th century with scabbards made of metal and plastic swords, and they were really beautifully made. And it's really a tribute what you could do with plastic if you were inspired and really cared about the craft of your product. Nothing wrong with plastic of itself. It's why do you use it? If you're using it only because you can cut down on craft, design, intelligence, creativity, and you can mass produce a rather dull object, then, of course, plasticity gets a bad name, and that's what was happening, was where you wanted to sit on a leather seat, you were suddenly sitting on a plastic one. The effect of the heat on a plastic one in summer, you know, it starts to smell, et cetera, et cetera. Cars, a lot of objects are starting to look uninteresting because there's less texture, less fabric. Clothes, again, simplified sometimes. There's a really classy form of 60s clothing, and then there was the ersatz rubbish that they were churning out for the supermarkets. Architecture, another thing. You can have 60s designs which are breathtaking and marvelous, and then you get the common thing I get the idea, we'll just use concrete and glass. Yes, and as long as there's lots of glass and concrete and it's all straight lines, that makes it modern. If we make it in plastic, that makes it modern. Everybody wanted to be modern, as it were, in the 60s. This was the thing, this escape from Victorian pre-war conditions, knock down anything that's old. And with that comes some intelligent design, but a hell of a lot of absolute rubbish. I often think that's really what was upsetting Christopher Booker, was the way things looked in the 60s, the cheap versions of toys, the cheap versions of hi-fis, etc., were absolutely appalling to somebody who grew up on people who knew at least 15 kinds of joints for woodwork and things like that. And suddenly, if you got wood, it was pine and it was glued. So there was a diminution of craftsmanship in the 60s, which I think was highly regrettable, and a failure to see the beauties of many old things. That starts to change in the late 60s and 70s, and the hippies actually, you know, especially in England, but I in America perhaps too, start to lament the going of the old look of places, cottages, old things. People start to collect antiques, not because they're valuable, but because they evoke a period where the individual mattered, the craftsmanship, the hand-painted plate that was painted by an individual rather than stamped and mass-produced.
All right, Tobias, I got to take a quick time out here. We'll come back and speak some more on the other side on Coast to Coast AM. Genetic researchers have reportedly solved a long-standing mystery surrounding a strange breed of rabbit that walks on its front feet rather than hopping. The curious creatures, which were first found in France back in the 1930s, are a domesticated species known as Sauteur d'Alfort. For reasons heretofore unknown, the bunnies are unable to jump and instead employ a bizarre method of locomotion wherein they lift themselves up on their front feet and walk. As one might imagine, their odd gait has puzzled scientists for nearly a century, but a new study appears to have determined the cause of their unique way of moving, and you can find out what that is. It's in the Highlight Carousel with video up at coasttocoastam.com. That rabbit sounds like it jumped right out of a Lewis Carroll novel. All right, back to more of my conversation with Tobias Churton as we examine the spirituality of the 60s right here on Coast to Coast AM. Tobias, do you think that over the years too much has been made with regards to the influence of Aleister Crowley on bands like the Beatles and Led Zeppelin, or was that connection, that influence, really there?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Richard. Too much made of it. I don't know who's. I'm not quite sure what you're referring to in terms of who's making too much of it, because I just thought it was, you know, one of very many components. That was. I think if it's to say that rock music is sort of evil and inspired by Satan, and there are covert messages to encourage young people to sell their souls to the devil. If that's the sort of thing you're referring to, then I'd say yes, definitely they've got it completely wrong, in my estimation. If it's the general idea was John Lennon influenced at all by Aleister Crowley, for example, I mean, obviously Jimmy Page finds Crowley philosophically stimulating, though he doesn't. He chooses not to talk about it, and it's not really reflected in the music of Led Zeppelin particularly. You can say it's a sort of atmosphere of late 60s rural occultism, if you want to call it like that, which is a sort of English folk tradition, really. John Lennon's case is a bit more interesting because he was open to philosophy. He was reading Timothy Leary, and he obviously did read some things about Aleister Crowley, though I have to say that in the mid to late 60s, there was very little material on Crowley available, quite honestly. Most of it was pirated, badly produced material. I don't think anyone got an accurate impression of Aleister Crowley in the 60s. At all. The OTO, for example, wasn't active. And Crowley's Confessions, which are an amusing read, weren't published until 1969, very late in the day indeed. I'd say rather that the 60s may have missed out from not knowing more about Aleister Crowley, might have given them more advice. People constantly misunderstood his "do what thou wilt" principle. As he said, they can't tell the difference between "do what thou wilt" and "do as thou wilt." Do as thou wilt, do as you please yourself, sort of anarchic kind of statement, is not what he was talking about. Anyway, "do what thou wilt" is really a religious injunction to find out who you are on the basis that every person has a particular destiny and should rise to it. That's the idea there, which is really the core idea of initiation from the earliest times. That's exactly what initiation's about, is going inside, getting into things. That's what esoteric means, to go inside. And there was a willingness to explore the inner universe in that period, as there certainly is today. So, if it's about Aleister Crowley is a black magician and his influence on rock, well, no, because Aleister Crowley was not a black magician. He was not dedicated to the cause of evil and harm and of people selling their souls to some curious power, devilish power, Satan, devil, whatever. That's a gross misinterpretation of his work.
Right, right. Oh, people have talked about, you know, Crowley's collection of poems called The Winged Beetle, and then Paul McCartney, after leaving the Beatles, forms a band called Wings. Was that kind of a paying homage to Crowley, or is that a coincidence?
I think the world is full of coincidences of that kind. I think, what is it, Connect Only Connect? I'm trying to think of the novelist who made that point. I think you can certainly overdo the connections. You know, if you wonder, if you're sort of tripping out on the idea that this is connected to that, there's no end to it, honestly. Down to Paul McCartney barefoot on Abbey Road must mean he's dead. You know, I think it's a terrible pit if you get over, if you start to turn everything in popular culture into a Kabbalistic puzzle. symbolize, everything's a symbol of something else. That, you know, the whole point is that people have an idea and then look for the evidence, which is just bad research. You let the evidence tell you, explore the evidence and see what that tells you first. And if you come up with a theory, it's only a theory, which means an outline of an idea. It then needs to be proved. The trouble with conspiracy theory is the last part goes out the window. You've already, by coming up with the theory, you regard it as proof. In other words, I can see these connections and that proves it. Well, no, you have merely taken some disparate material and united them by a theory you've imposed upon them. And this way madness lies, and we see an awful lot of it today. I believe very much that you must learn to discriminate between speculation and provable fact. And if we do that more often, we'll be less prone to accept the latest bit of cosmic gossip.
We just have, I guess, about 12 minutes here. I wanted to talk about another aspect of the 60s, and that was apocalypticism. And the idea that, you know, there was this transformation happening in the 60s. You had sort of the end of time, the end of days type Christian apocalypse. But then there was a transformation into kind of a more from fearfulness to hopefulness, a new age, I guess, referring to what, the age of Aquarius. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the first time in history, arguably, the apocalypse becomes not an imaginative fear, a bogey story you tell children what might happen if they are unfortunate to get caught up in this apocalypse. But with the threat of nuclear annihilation, you have the possible realization of the end of the world. Of course, this misunderstands the original meaning of apocalyptic literature. Apocalypse means to bring out of hiding, literally apocalypsis, to take something that's been hidden and we're going to tell you what's really happening. And apocalyptic books were written to give hope to people, actually, that this world would be wound up, but a far better one would replace it. In the 60s apocalypse, there's no new one to replace it. If this world goes nuclear winter, that's it, mate. That's the end. This is the end, as Jim Morrison sang. Now, it's interesting that apocalyptic in the late antiquity it transmorphs into Gnosticism, where the new hope is interior, and you see a very similar process going on in the 60s. Out of the fear of nuclear confrontation develops a positive view that if we go back to the authentic spirit in man and build on this, that we will in fact from within exude outwardly a new world, but you have to start inside. As Jesus said, first clean the inside of the cup in order to have the new wine. So, and that hope that a new world will come from this new awareness that's growing, is this optimism grows exponentially in the late 60s. And then, of course, goes through these series of disappointments. And there's a great reaction to it, great reaction, as you would expect from a positive spiritual experience. You always get the other side comes in then, oh, no, this is all rubbish, etc. And, of course, you then had the petrol crisis of 1973, the Manson murders, Altamont, all these things are blown up by the press as, it just shows the new world didn't happen. It's and we must get back to the stock market where we belong, which is our home. Buying and selling stocks is what life's really all about, and we can stop this 60s rubbish and put a lid on it, and we'll give the children a sort of form of pop music but deny the substance thereof. And next stop is the discotheque at the agreed hours, and conformity tries to slam the whole thing shut. So yes, but you're absolutely right, apocalypse becomes a positive thing. Except in the religious circles, where it's still regarded as a cure for all mankind's sins, and is still regarded that way today. It's the easiest answer, isn't it? If you've got a problem, let's destroy everything. that's the way to deal with it. But you can transform things. You can take the elements that exist and do wonders with them. You can take an old thing and make it new. I think that's the inner apocalypse, which is well worth engaging with. You accept the world as it is, and then you do your best to improve it, step by step.
After the 60s, you mentioned the 70s and what happened, you know, the loss of hope and so forth. And you, I think you draw in the book, you draw a parallel between Lennon quitting the Beatles and sort of retreating. You know, ultimately, he would spend 5 years baking bread and being the house husband inside the Dakota. But in the 70s, that was the me decade. What happened? What happened? So, I mean, obviously, we talked about, you know, Manson and Altamont and all the negativity, but what happened to all of those former hippies in the 70s? Why did it turn around into the me decade?
Yes, I'm not sure it did turn into the me decade. That's one of those journalistic little sketches that was, there was the us decade and now there's the me decade. And it's obviously a criticism of the kind of psychology movements that were developing in the 70s and people's neurosis and loss of contact with community and so on, and the polarization that comes in the 70s. But all of those factors were there before. Where John Lennon's concerned, I think it's a kind of exhaustion. I think he started with an enormous enthusiastic energy to become a prophet of peace in 1969. It's his coming out of his LSD revelations and his Maharishi period and meeting Yoko and her priorities, which are rooted in the experience of Tokyo at the end of World War II. A peaceful world, isn't that something the Beatles can create? And John, you could argue, foolishly took on the mantle himself to some degree and put his resources, personal resources, energy, effort into this movement. But I think by the end of 69, after the meeting with Trudeau in Ottawa in late 69, and he then gets wrapped up with a plan to do a super mega Woodstock, and then he decides it must be free, a word that is not really understood by the backers, who were producing posters saying, come to this festival free for $1, free for $1. And Lennon reacts against this. Now, meanwhile, the Beatles are in bad condition amongst themselves. They're arguing about money, which, of course, is one of the great causes of divorce. And there is a feeling that I think he gets exhausted by the peace movement and the weight of responsibility, which is suddenly falling on his shoulders. And Trudeau had said to Lennon, you know, you organize this, I'll provide you with some Canadian government backing. And I think John Lennon was many things, but one thing I don't think he ever really liked was personal responsibility. That wasn't something he liked, to be creative and dynamic, but I don't think he wanted to get into too much into the business of things. And I think he's starting to withdraw a bit. But there are other problems going on in his life at that time, which I detail in the book. I don't think he wanted to give it up. But he has this Arthur Janov's book turns up in the Post, saying that really all this stuff about peace, love, and religion is due to birth trauma. And you can expiate this birth trauma through screaming. Now, this ties in with some of Yoko's artistic ideas. And he begins to question, I think this is what happens, he begins to question whether becoming, you know, Mr. Peace in this particular way he was going about it was necessarily the right thing to do. And I think that he's aware that things are changing. And I think it's almost inadvertent. When you see the process by which the energy starts to suddenly fall down as 69 becomes 70, you really feel what it is he's groping. He thought he'd got a fantastic vision of the future, but some doubt has crept in. It's quite mysterious in a way. And, of course, by the next summer, Paul McCartney has filed for the dissolution of the Beatles business partnership. And his attentions begin to move into sort of a period of strife, and he gets more involved with what he thought was practical politics of the left wing, and the movement bifurcates and the moment is lost. I personally think the 60s ended on the 20th of July 1969 when Armstrong and Aldrin walked on the moon, because I think that was the true culmination of the energy. It was the 60s is a creation of President Kennedy. He said, we will put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. And that defines the decade, this upward-going, enormous march into infinity to break the bonds of earthbound consciousness, to go to another world. The lunar world is it's tremendous. It was indeed the great step for mankind that Armstrong said it was. And once it's achieved on that magical day, I remember so well, July 1969, and Woodstock comes a couple of weeks later, once the mist clears from that, there's a kind of coldness, a bit like a room after a party's been in it, and everybody's gone, and there's just bits of things lying around, and there's a sort of, where did the atmosphere go? So I do think the 60s truly peaks like a high, and then there's the aftermath, and the aftermath is always, in these cases, is a downer. And you get this cultural disappointment, which the mainstream press are only too pleased to encourage, that, you've had your party. Wasn't it all a bit threatening? Didn't the establishment shake a bit? But it's back to normal now. Oh, but you can have your long hair, you can have your wide lapels, you can have your coloured tie, you can have a regulation amount of psychedelicism, but we ain't going to rock the boat anymore, are we? And that's sort of my sense of it.
And Tobias, if you had been a little older during the 60s, because you were, quite young, would you have been a mod, a rocker, a hippie, or a freak?
Oh, definitely a freak. Yes, a freak probably the essence of freak is anti-conformist. It's not about conforming or non-conforming, it's anti-conformist. So I would have probably had a regulation short back and sides haircut, but inside I'd also all sorts of beautiful things cooking. But I wouldn't want to necessarily announce my inner life in a way that people could immediately label. I would have used a more subtle methods of communicating with my fellow creatives. I would have probably done similar things to what I do now, which is write and music and films and all these beautiful ways of contacting the eternal truths.
Tobias, it's been a real pleasure.
I don't think I'd have bothered with the drugs, personally.
Good man. All right, Tobias, a great pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much, Richard. It has been a pleasure. Thank you.
The Spiritual Meaning of the 60s. All right. For George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyon, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Michael Cozio, Melissa Rodriguez, Donna Walker, Chris Burrows, I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. Until next Friday, so long for now.